This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan blames the assassination of Benazir Bhutto on al-Qaeda and its allies. The president himself narrowly escaped two assassination plots a few years ago, also said to be the work of al-Qaeda, and the Osama bin Laden group is also the main suspect in a recent series of suicide bombs targeted on the Pakistani military. At the same time, al-Qaeda and the Taliban have established training and logistical facilities in Pakistan to support their stepped-up war in Afghanistan. Bin Laden and his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, are widely reported to live and operate a reconstituted al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Our main focus today is Pakistan, al-Qaeda, and the Taliban. We'll also talk about two Facebook pages of Benazir Bhutto's son, one a hoax. And later in the hour, Mark Fisher of the Washington Post and Carrie Sherman of the RIAA on the allegation that you might get yourself sued if you transfer a CD you bought to your computer or to your iPod. But first, if you want to know more about Pakistan, al-Qaeda, and the Taliban, our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Peter Bergen, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, who's written two books on al-Qaeda and joins us by phone from Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. And Peter, thanks for staying up to join us today.
No problem.
There are many in Pakistan who believe the government was either complicit or negligent in the assassination of Benazir Bhutto a week ago today. How credible is President Musharraf's statement that puts the blame on terrorists associated with al-Qaeda?
Well, Neil, I think, you know, Occam's razor is reasonably employed here in the sense that who had the most to gain? Musharraf was already one of the least popular politicians in Pakistan, and his popularity certainly hasn't benefited from this assassination attempt. Also, the senior levels of the military have no interest in instability in the country, and clearly this brought instability to the country. On the other hand, Taliban and al-Qaeda allies, you know, have long opposed Benazir Bhutto, somebody that they've targeted in the past. There was also, you probably know, Neil, a recording of Bayatullah Massoud, the Taliban leader in Pakistan, in which he basically takes credit for the bombing, clearly has some knowledge of it. The transcript was released, then the audio tape was released, and is actually out on a Pakistani government website for those who might be interested. And, you know, if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's very probably a duck. Of course, it's very convenient for the government that so quickly somebody was identified as the perpetrator. As to the question of their negligence, I mean, I think rather than their complicity, that's a much fairer assessment. I mean, clearly the Pakistan People's Party was asking for the government for better security. People within the party saying that they wanted some sort of international security firm, but were blocked by the Interior Ministry from getting permission for that. And if you look at those videotapes, Neil, taken of the attack, it's pretty obvious that the security around her was not professional. In a similar kind of assassination attempt against an American political figure, as soon as the first gunshot went off, there would be people moving towards the gun, but instead everybody's moving away or ducking.
Yet the government issued numbers today suggesting there were 1,000 policemen ordered and raising the question that, hey, you know, who told her to stand up in the vehicle? Everybody else who stayed inside was okay.
Well, you know, I think that's a little bit of blaming the victim. You know, there's still a controversy about how exactly she died. I've looked at the medical report as well as those videotapes, and actually the government position that she died falling and then she hit her head on the sun lever, I think, is actually borne out by the medical report. There's no exit wound noted in the medical report. There's also no fragments of bullets were found. Now, the medical report is not an autopsy, which has yet to be formed and may never be performed. However, the medical report does seem to militate against either a gunshot or even a sniper shot, which some people have alleged.
Okay, getting back to the broader question, though, of Pakistan and al-Qaeda, at the same time, the Pakistani government is an ally with the U.S. In the war on terrorism. President Bush reaffirmed that again today. And at the same time, it's the place where al-Qaeda is believed to be located. How does that square?
Well, this is a tricky one. There's no doubt that the Pakistani government has made some pretty good faith efforts against al-Qaeda, particularly in the 2001-2004 period, where they arrested a lot of major al-Qaeda figures in some of the big Pakistani cities. But I think al-Qaeda made a strategic decision to move back into the tribal areas because they were taking so much heat in the city, so they're a harder target. And the second factor here is that the Pakistani government has suffered severe casualties. Up to 1,000 security personnel have died in fighting Taliban or al-Qaeda. But nonetheless, your larger point is well taken, which is, according to the National Intelligence Estimate of released last year, al-Qaeda is reconstituted in Pakistan. The Taliban on both sides of the border are stronger than they've been really since the pre-9/11 period. So, you know, this goes to the question of, is there a lack of will in the Pakistani government to deal with this problem? Is there a lack of capability? Is it a little bit of both, perhaps?
When we say the Pakistani government, it could also be that we tend to think of governments as monolithic things that do what the president tells them to do. Maybe not the case in Pakistan.
Well, that's true. And you know, Pakistan is not a very easy country to govern. It's riven by ethnic tensions. It's a quite poor country that is getting a little richer in the recent years. You know, Karachi, the city where Benazir Bhutto was attacked for the first time in October, is a barely governable city of something like 15 million, where good parts of the city are no-go areas for the police and the like. So, you know, I'm not sort of making excuses here for the Pakistani government. I'm simply trying to explain what the situation is. The fact is that I think the Pakistani government was willing to move against al-Qaeda, but basically didn't really move against the Taliban, and the Taliban remains headquartered in places like Quetta and Peshawar, big cities on the Pakistan-Afghan border, Neil.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we get some listeners in on this conversation. Of course, our guest is Peter Bergen, author of Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden and the Osama Bin Laden I Know. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Kesser. Kesser with us from West Bend in Wisconsin.
Yes, I, in fact, met her the day before she was assassinated. I was in Pakistan, and I left the morning she was assassinated, and I was...
You're speaking of Benazir Bhutto.
Yes, yes. She basically visited my family, and I can guarantee you, when I looked at her security, and when I compared it with anybody else who with that stature, I felt that she was not given enough protection when she came to where we were supposed to meet. There were hundreds of people who were no more than 5 to 6 feet away from her, and I immediately at that time thought I had two of my brothers standing right across from me, and the only thing I could think was if there's a bomb blast, all three of us are going to go. So I felt the vibration of anything that could happen, and I believe that it is the stubbornness and the cockiness of the president of Pakistan that is creating all the this chaos. I think if he's gone, things will stabilize. I mean, we are a country with a history of 5,000 years and more, and we have never been given a chance by the military of Pakistan to stabilize, and I blame U.S. foreign policy and the military of Pakistan for that.
All right. Well, let's leave those last points alone. We've talked about them in other days and will on other days, but we're focusing on Pakistan and al-Qaeda. And Peter Bergen, this goes back to your point of maybe negligence caused by, as our caller suggests, hubris on the part of the government.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's certainly a certain amount of negligence, but I mean, let's bear in mind that also some other major Pakistani political figures have been the subject of very serious assassination attempts, and you know, not least, as you pointed out in the introduction, Musharraf himself, who was the subject of two assassination attempts in Rawalpindi, the very place that Benazir Bhutto was killed, which he narrowly avoided being killed in, and of course, the interior minister, the former interior minister, also. The subject of a very serious assassination attempt, one that came 6 days before Benazir Bhutto was killed, where he was actually targeted when he was praying in a mosque, which is about as low as you can go, it seems to me. And that attack did not kill him, but killed 50 other people. So when you've got a group of people willing to commit suicide in these attacks have generally been suicide operations. In fact, they've generally involved more than one suicide attacker. Whether that was the Benazir Bhutto case in Karachi, that was also true in the Rawalpindi case where they killed her, that was also true in one of the Musharraf assassination attempts. These sorts of attacks are actually quite hard to prevent, which is, again, not to let the Pakistani government off the hook, because you know, the Pakistan's People Party was asking for additional international security firms to come in and really take care of her security, which had really been defaulted two party workers who were armed, and then of course there were Pakistani police in the area where she was assassinated, but clearly they weren't up to the job.
Hmm. Let's see, get one more caller in before we have to go to a break. Kathleen with us from Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. But Mr. Bergen, I believe it was you who you were on Talk of the Nation several other times before the invasion and right after. And I believe it was you who said that Osama bin Laden wished to see the U.S. become a shadow of its former self. And I wanted to ask, how successful do you think he has been? And that Osama bin Laden has also stated that Michael Schuster, the ex-head of the CIA bin Laden unit, has the deepest understanding of what Osama bin Laden is after. And Schuster has said that al-Qaeda and bin Laden are very angry about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and U.S. military bases in the Middle East. So what do you think al-Qaeda and bin Laden want?
I think you mean Michael Scherer, but go ahead.
Michael Schuer. That's right. I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead. Or even if you asked him, he'd say Michael Scheuer, but that's neither here nor there. Mike Scheuer, I think, who was head of the CIA's bin Laden unit, has basically said that, bin Laden's principal gripes with the United States are its foreign policy in the Middle East, its supposed ability to control the price of oil, its support for Israel, and other issues. And clearly, I met with bin Laden in 97, and he, when we did the first television interview with him for CNN, and, he hit all those issues. I mean, clearly, bin Laden's critique of the United States is not a cultural critique. He's strangely silent about Britney Spears or Hollywood or Madonna or, drugs, alcohol, feminism, homosexuality, the kinds of cultural critiques that a lot of people on, let's say, the fundamentalist Christian side in the United States have of the United States. Instead, it's really a foreign policy critique. How successful has he been in his plan to, basically rid the Muslim world of American influence? I would say it's been a total failure. I mean, the United States is a major presence in Afghanistan now. It's a major presence in Iraq. Countries around the Muslim world are probably more closely allied to the United States than they were even before 9/11.
Peter, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Kathleen, thanks for the call. And Peter, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Peter Bergen, author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know, with us on the line from Islamabad. More on al-Qaeda and Pakistan coming up. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Pakistan has long been a puzzle, an American ally in the war on terrorism that, at the same time, has suspected links to both al-Qaeda and the Taliban. If you have questions about Pakistan's fraught relationships, you're invited to join our conversation. Our number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now from his home in London is Sajan Gohel, Director of International Security for the Asia-Pacific Foundation. And Sajan, Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us today.
Happy New Year, and good to be with you today.
And getting back to that same question we were talking with to Peter Bergen about, what are the links? How do you square the idea of Pakistan as an ally in the war against terror at the same time as the country that apparently harbors both al-Qaeda and the Taliban?
Keep in mind that Pakistan was a reluctant ally in the war on terrorism. General Musharraf, or now President Musharraf, who launched a coup back in 1999 when he overthrew the democratically elected Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, had become isolated. The country itself was being crippled by economic debt. 9/11 altered the scenario substantially and provided Pakistan an opportunity to come back into a mainstream society. But bear in mind also that there's long been a symmetrical relationship between Pakistan's military and the religious extremists. And it's important to remember that the military was deeply concerned about the return of Benazir Bhutto and her political rival Nawaz Sharif, as they both wanted to limit its overbearing influence on counterterrorism policy. And that is something that concerned the military substantially. And what has been worrying is that Pakistan has been beset with numerous and conflicting security challenges, resulting in intractable and also quite discernible dilemmas. Now, often these conflicts spill over ethnically and geographically, fueling ethnic and communal problems. And a lot of the domestic terrorist groups that were used to carry out attacks in, say, Kashmir against Indian troops or supporting the Taliban, eventually became merged within the Al-Qaeda ideology. And the worrying situation is that there is this ideological sympathy within elements of the military with Al-Qaeda, and therefore there is this concern as to how committed they are in rooting out the dregs of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban that exist inside the country.
Are you saying that at various times Pakistan's armed forces or its intelligence services have used terrorist groups as instruments of state policy?
That has been the case in the past. Bear in mind that Pakistan's own notorious intelligence agency, the ISI, has been responsible in the past for creating a sectarian conflict inside the country against the Shia minority. It's also been accused of supporting terrorist groups that have operated in Kashmir, some of whom then became aligned with Al-Qaeda itself. And of course, the brainchild of the Taliban was the ISI itself. It was very much their pet project, which they had to reluctantly relinquish in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. So it was a sort of a perverse irony, perhaps, that we were asking the same apparatus to dismantle the networks that had actually given these groups the ability to set up shop inside Pakistan. And unfortunately, there's still many question marks as to how committed they are in dealing with these different nefarious groups.
Let's get another caller on the line. Chuck in San Francisco. Chuck's on the line.
Thank you very much. I was wondering if perhaps the ambivalence that seems to be apparent in the policy, well, I guess I have two theories I'd be interested in finding out about. One is that it has a lot to do with not only sympathy with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the military, but in the general population. That's what I've heard about areas like Waziristan and such. And secondly, if the asymmetric nature of a lot of the conflicts in the world nowadays, especially given our military might, doesn't lead to the growth of a lot of sort of symbiotic relationships between governments and proxy non-governmental organizations like Iran maybe has with Hamas and Hezbollah as a way of kind of having influence in, Israel or Lebanon, much in the same way that Pakistan might have relationships with groups that they don't have direct control over, but it's a kind of symbiotic thing.
Mm-hmm. Plausibly deniable proxy.
Right.
Is that the case here, do you think, Sir John Gohel?
Well, that had become one of the major problems in the past, that the support and sponsoring of different insurgent groups was designed to give Pakistan strategic depth. One was to bleed the Indian soldiers in Indian-administered Kashmir, and the other was to enhance Pakistan's own geopolitical interests in Afghanistan by supporting the Taliban. However, what resulted in that is that these groups slowly became more independent. They became more affiliated with the Al-Qaeda school of thinking, and they turned on their master and are now actually carrying out attacks against the same entities that were created by them. So it's always become that worry that it's, in effect, a Frankenstein's monster, that these now same groups are responsible for most of the attacks that are taking place inside Pakistan. And of course, the worry has been that the military itself has become Islamicized. Pakistan's previous military dictator, General Zia-ul-Haq, who was again seen as an ally of the West, especially during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, he turned the army into a religious institution, which it hasn't really recovered from since. And the worry has always been is that the military itself is divided over its direction and how it deals in this war on terrorism.
So is there much sympathy, my first part of my question, with Al-Qaeda in the general population in Pakistan?
Unfortunately, there is this level of sympathy towards Al-Qaeda. Many individuals do not view terrorist groups like AQ or the Taliban the same way we do. I think what has been very harmful is the fact that Western governments continue to support and endorse people like Musharraf, who himself has become deeply unpopular inside the country. Bear in mind that Pakistan, up till very recently, had a developed civil society, an independent judiciary, and a vibrant, active press. When Musharraf declared his state of emergency in November last year, he dismantled all those institutions, and there was not enough condemnation by Western leaders. All that did is result in a lot of hatred towards Western capitals. Al-Qaeda exploited the situation and said, look, this is the type of puppet that the West supports. He's doing their bidding. And the propaganda war, which unfortunately Washington has lost significantly over the last 2 years, has fallen, has failed. And groups like Al-Qaeda have exploited the situation.
And I just want to interrupt. And then they go for more popularity by killing the most popular politician in Pakistan.
We have to be careful about who killed Benazir Bhutto. The government of Pakistan talks about the fact that she was assassinated by an individual known as Bayatullah Mehshood. Now, he is a local warlord from South Waziristan. And he is not directly connected to Al-Qaeda. Unfortunately, what we find nowadays is that wherever there's a terrorist attack or an assassination, often governments would like to purport the Al-Qaeda line because it perhaps enhances their credibility. It may give them more funding by governments. Bayatullah Mehshood has embarrassed the military of Pakistan primarily because he's been abducting soldiers, holding them ransom. He's become a major thorn in Musharraf's side. And if we also take the views of Benazir Bhutto's political party, the Pakistan's People Party, the PPP, they don't believe that Mehshood was involved either. In fact, they're accusing elements of the military to have been involved. And I think the important point is what Peter Bergen mentioned earlier as to who had the most to gain from her assassination. And unfortunately, it's the military, because they were deeply worried that she would curtail their influence and power inside the country. Because the military itself has been the most powerful institution in Pakistan since its independence in 1947.
All right. Thanks, Chuck, for the call.
Thank you.
And you we mentioned in passing Waziristan. We've talked about these tribal areas that are along the Pakistan border with Afghanistan. Why is it that Pakistan does not directly control these territories? Who does? And why is it so difficult for even Pakistani government forces to operate there?
Well, South Waziristan is one of the seven provinces or regions of what's called the Federally Administered Tribal Area, FATA. It's in effect a state, it's geographically been divided under three regions normally, northern, central, and southern, and it's played a very important role in the subcontinent of South Asia. It's known for its harsh and steep mountainous land interspersed with many passes, the Khyber Pass being the most famous of all of them. And they've almost been a de facto independent region inside Pakistan, where local tribespeople control the territory. They make the rules, they make the decisions, they are in fact the lawmakers. The central government of Pakistan never got involved in the internal affairs until after September 11th. And what is concerning and worrying is that these regions are, again, ideologically very sympathetic towards the Taliban. They're the same Pashtun ethnicity as the Taliban, and they've been giving sanctuary to them for the last 20 years, whether it was under the guise of the Afghan Mujahideen that were fighting the Soviets, or under the present circumstances with the Taliban. And they've been using that base in the federally administered tribal areas to carry out attacks against coalition troops in Afghanistan, namely the US and British troops. And it's become a problem because of the fact that the military in Pakistan is now reducing its emphasis and focus on it. In fact, they made a peace deal with local tribespeople in 2006 under the premise that they would, that the local tribespeople would not harbor the Taliban. That deal failed within a month, and we saw an upsurge in violence. So the Pakistani authorities do not have a grip on the situation there, and unfortunately it's beginning to spread, because in the neighboring province, which is called Northwest Frontier Province, 18 out of the 24 districts have now fallen under Taliban control. So the situation is escalating, and it's becoming more worrying.
And finally, we've just had several callers raise the point that in an interview with David Frost on Al Jazeera, I think in November, Benazir Bhutto said that Osama bin Laden was dead.
I think, as we all do, we tend to say one thing when we're talking about something else. I do recall that interview. Benazir Bhutto was referring to the case of Ahmed Omar Syed Sheikh. Now, he was a British citizen of Pakistani origin that was involved in the abduction of Daniel Pearl. and Sheikh was connected to Osama bin Laden. And I think Benazir Bhutto was actually trying to refer to him and his involvement with another individual, Maulana Masood Azhar, who together set up the terrorist group, the Jaish-e-Mohammed, which was again an affiliate towards Al-Qaeda and gave sanctuary to its members. So I think Benazir Bhutto made a slip there. It was accidental. I don't think there's any conspiratorial thing involved in that, because she certainly wanted to find bin Laden. She made that her major platform on her return to Pakistan. And certainly, I think we can be pretty certain he's out there based on the recent video message that came out. And that remains to be the worry, the fact that when bin Laden issues his audio or video message, it elicits a psychological reaction to galvanize supporters around the world to take up arms against Western society. And that is something we always need to bear in mind.
Sir John Gohel, thanks very much for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Sir John Gohel, Director of International Security for the Asia-Pacific Foundation, with us on the line from his home in London. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now, a strange convergence of social network spoof and journalism intruded on the turmoil in Pakistan when the Pakistan People's Party named 19-year-old Bilawal Bhutto Zardari to succeed his grandfather and his mother as chairman. Reporters fell all over themselves to find out more about him. And since Bilawal is a teenager, many went immediately to Facebook, the social networking website where kids around the world post their pictures, their dreams, random thoughts, and sometimes much more. Joining us now is Mike Nitza, a reporter for the New York Times, who writes their news blog called The Lead. He's at his desk in New York. And Mike Nitza, thanks very much for being with us.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Tell us what happened. Bilawal does have a Facebook page?
Yes. We've gotten several confirmations that he does have a Facebook page, and it was involved in the first round of media coverage. It's within the Oxford University network. He built it when he went there for school under the alias that he's known as there, which was his first name spelled backwards, using a surname. We confirmed it with a fellow student who also lived in a dorm with him. And, so that page is real.
And then there's another page.
There's one other page that I am aware of where it was using not his alias but his official name, the name that we use in the Times. And that one was definitely not real, and it was taken down yesterday.
And do we know who made it and why?
I have a pretty good idea. I'm fairly confident I know who did it, because there is this internet prankster bulletin board that turned up in a Google blog search, and the updates from this prankster who's known as Tone track with the updates to the Facebook page and the reactions that we can see throughout the web at various news outlets.
And there was, though, a theory in Pakistan from the PPP, the Pakistan People's Party, that the faux page had been created by the Pakistani government to discredit Bilawal.
Yes, that is unsurprising in that a lot of things get blamed on Musharraf lately in Pakistan, but I'd be very surprised to find out that the Pakistani intelligence was working with a guy like Tone.
There's some interesting questions that all this raises.
Oh yes, definitely. Interesting questions and interesting, very familiar tale that we see play out over and over again in the media. So in one way, you have a familiar tale of a young person who's embarrassed by their Facebook page when scrutiny comes. Potential employers, colleges, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And that real Facebook page had, for example, a picture of Bilawal in a devil's costume going out on Halloween, pretty mild for Oxford, pretty hot stuff in Karachi, maybe.
Yes, exactly. And there was also some fairly earnest statements from him. He was just a 19-year-old kid. It's from all indications from the Facebook page and other profiles done of him, based on people that knew him, he was just a normal kid getting ready for college.
Mm. And at the same time, the spoof raises some pretty interesting questions too.
Oh yes, it's Facebook took this matter very seriously. While I was watching the fake Facebook page spread throughout various media outlets, Facebook was investigating behind the scenes to see whether or not it was fake. They got several reports from users earlier saying that it looked fishy, and they definitely have a standard operating procedure that they go through in these kinds of cases, and they took it down as soon as they decided that it was fake.
And some of the fake stuff had also been quoted by more mainstream outlets. Do you think in the future people will be a little bit more hesitant before they publish this stuff?
Yes, I guess it was surprising in that, yes, that you know, in hindsight, you have pretty trustworthy news organizations caught up in this, like Canada's Globe and Mail, and
others.
Yeah, a lot of others. And so you have those, but in another way, it's not surprising in that Facebook was kind of becoming the source for information for anyone reporting on young people. If you recall, during the Virginia Tech,
sure. Anyway, Mike Nitza, I mispronounced it. Thanks very much for your name. Mike Nitza writes The Lead, the New York Times general news blog, and he joined us today from his office in New York. When we come back, stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.